Welcome to Destination Murder, the true crime podcast.
Each week the hosts, that's us, BFS Megan
and Tegan,
cover stories from a new part of the world.
Get ready to combat your travel bug and feed your true crime obsession.
Hey Tegan, how's it going?
Kind of okay.
Kind of okay. What's wrong?
I had a couple drinks last night. I'm a little tired.
That's understandable. It's not right now, but when people are listening to this, it's January 20th, which is the start of Aquarius season.
Mm-hmm.
So happy early Aquarius season, Tegan.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be in our house of us. And it would mean that it's 2 days away from your birthday and 5 days away from mine. So I'm expecting some presents, like some follows on Instagram, some likes on our Facebook page, you know, some more listens, telling your friends.
Oh, yeah. Give us a review. That would be the best birthday present ever.
Yeah.
But speaking of birthdays, we will talk about this at the end of the episode. But next week is not going to be our typical pull the country or city or state or province at the end of the episode. We will be doing, because it's our birthday, our gift to ourselves is we get to choose wherever we want to go. But then the episode after that, we will be back to our regular schedule.
Yeah, of pulling places out of a computer-generated guessing machine.
Yes. So just a heads up, please don't get mad at us. It is our birthday. It is our podcast. We do what we want.
We decide the rules. That's the great thing about doing things that are your own. You get to decide to change the rules if you want. You get to come up with new rules. You get to throw all caution to the wind.
Before we get started, I just want to say thank you, and I'm sure Tegan also wants to say thank you. This past week, we have gotten so many lovely messages on Instagram. So thank you for that. You can also follow our Instagram at Destination Murder Pod if you don't know we have an Instagram. But yeah, we've been getting a lot of really nice messages. So we just wanted to shout all of you out if you sent us a message or a comment. Thank you very much.
Megan kept sending me screenshots and I was like literally just like almost crying in my car. I was like, I'm so excited. Happy tears, not sad tears, but it was just like, wow, like, I was not expecting anyone other than, like, people that we knew to listen to us. So it's really nice to hear positive feedback from strangers because it's so cool. I'm glad you're listening. And we're happy to have you here. You're our new friends. Welcome. Mm-hmm.
We love being in your ear holes.
Yeah.
Are you tired of me saying that yet?
Never. Also on Twitter, we've had some people from around the globe retweet a couple of our posts. So we do also have a Twitter as well if you want to follow us on that. It is,
I think it's like dest_murder. But yeah, oh, there was something else that I wanted to say, but I cannot remember what I was going to say. Oh well.
It's fine. It will come back to you, I'm sure.
It came back to me. I haven't checked, but I think we're almost at 1,000 streams.
Yeah.
Which is insane.
Yeah, I was also a little bit mind blown about that. Is that overall or is that just on one platform?
I think that's overall.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's enough about us bragging about ourselves.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're here for one reason and one reason only, and that is the murder. So, Tegan, I think you're first this week.
Am I?
I think so.
I always got so confused with other podcasts when they were like, do I go first this week or do you go first this week? And now
but I understand.
I'm like, what? It's so easy to just remember, but everything just melds into one. Okay, if you're saying I'm going first, then I'm going first. I just want to preface this story. Oh, I guess maybe I should say where I'm going to first. I'm taking you to Iraq. The case that I will be covering is super, super, super sad. So if you don't want to hear this, Maybe scroll through your little time bar to Megan's. But it is pretty upsetting. Yeah. So I am doing the Mamoudieh rape and killings.
This sounds very sad.
My sources this week are Wikipedia, Al Jazeera, The New York Times, and The Guardian.
Very reputable sources, may I just say.
I know. I feel so fancy whenever I have crazy sources like that.
Versus me, you'll see in one my case, but my case is just like one long Reddit thread.
Okay, it's not just Daily Mail.
A spoiler, but yeah, not Daily Mail. Oh my gosh. Daily reminder, the Daily Mail is a trash news source. It is not news. It is a tabloid that hates women. Just
and,
letting you know.
They spread false lies about my husband, Harry Styles, being in love with a woman named Olivia Wilde. Anyways.
Okay. Sorry. Continue.
I'm just trying to like make things a little bit light before I get into this. Okay. So the Mamoudieh rape and killings were a war crime involving a gang rape and murder of a 14-year-old Iraqi girl and the murder of her family. This is where it gets bad. By the United States Army soldiers on March 12th, 2006.
I think I remember hearing about this.
Yeah, I was trying to think of how old we were. 10. Mm-hmm. So,
I didn't hear about it when I was 10, but I've heard about it since.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But yeah, okay. It makes me really upset that people that are supposed to be over in that area protecting other people were not doing what they were supposed to be doing.
And they were kind of there
for absolutely no good reason.
Absolutely no good reason.
Yeah. Okay. So Abir Qasim Hazama Al-Jabani lived with her mother and father, Fakria Taha Musan, who was 34, and Qasim Hazama Rahim, who is 45, and her three siblings, 6-year-old Hadil, 9-year-old brother Ahmed, and 11-year-old brother Mohammed. Abir's family lived in a one-bedroom house that they did not own. They borrowed furniture, and they lived in a village of Yusufia, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, which lies west of the larger township of Al-Mamoudieh. In Iraq. The family was very close. Her father, Qasim, worked as a guard at a date orchard, and Abir's mother, Fakira, was a stay-at-home mom. Hadil, Abir's 6-year-old sister, loved a sweet plant that grew in the yard, was playful but not mischievous, and enjoyed playing hide-and-seek with her brothers. Qasim doted on his family, hoping that one day he would be able to buy a home for them and that they would live and eat like everybody else.
Aw, that's so sad.
Which makes me, yeah, really sad. He also had a dream that his children would finish college. According to her neighbors at the time of the massacre, Abir spent most of her days at home as her parents would not allow her to go to school because of security concerns, which really sucks. Like, the fact that you can't go and get educated because of security reasons.
And also the fact that they were doing all they could to protect her, and it seems like even them concerned about her going to school for security reasons didn't save her in the end.
Yeah. And it's kind of, I was going to say funny, but it's not really funny, but like, her two brothers were at school when this happened, and they are the only survivors. So
that's horrible.
Yeah. And it's crazy that the boys were allowed to go to school, and but as a girl, she wasn't allowed to go because of security concerns. So I don't really know what...
I wonder if they were explicitly concerned about Americans in the U.S. Army, or if they were concerned about, like, locals as well.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure. So Abir, having only been born months after the Gulf War, which devastated civilian infrastructure in Iraq, and living her entire life under sanctions, followed by the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, Abir had dreams as well, hoping to one day live in the big city, which is Baghdad, and her relatives described her as proud. Although she was only a 14-year-old child, Abir endured repeated sexual harassment from U.S. soldiers. Abir's family was situated approximately 200 meters from a six-man U.S. traffic checkpoint southwest of the village. From their checkpoint, the soldiers would often watch Abir doing her chores and tending to the garden. The neighbors had warned Abir's father of this, but he replied that it was not a problem as she was just a small girl. Abir's brother, Mohammed, recalls that the soldiers often searched the house. On one such occasion, Private First Class Stephen D. Green ran his index finger down Abir's cheek, an action which had terrified her. Abir's mother told her relatives before the murders that whenever she caught the soldiers staring at Abir, they would give her a thumbs up sign, point to her daughter, and say, "Very good, very good." Which is disgusting.
That's so disgusting.
Evidently, this had concerned her, and she made plans for Abir to spend nights sleeping at her uncle's house. According to an affidavit later filed by the FBI, Green discussed raping the girl in the days preceding the event.
So, essentially, this was a planned attack.
Mm-hmm. So, on March 12, 2006, soldiers at the checkpoint consisting of Green, so the above mentioned, Specialist Paul E. Cortez, Specialist James P. Parker, Private First Class Jesse V. Spielman, and Private First Class Brian L. Howard had been playing cards, illegally drinking alcohol, which was whiskey mixed with an energy drink, which, gross.
I was just going to ask if this was the American drinking it or the father of the girl. And then as soon as you said energy drink, I was like, it's the American.
Yeah. Hitting golf balls and discussing plans to rape Abir and kill some Iraqis. Green was very persistent about killing some Iraqis and kept bringing up the idea. Specialist Paul E. Cortez said this while they were in court, saying, "While we were playing cards, Barker and Green started talking about having sex with an Iraqi female. Barker and Green had already known," Cortez said, "before breaking down. He bowed his head and remained silent, sniffling occasionally for a full minute before continuing. Barker and Green had already known what house they wanted to go to, knew only one male was in the house, and they knew it would be an easy target." One, that's awful that they were talking about that. Two, it's disgusting that they wanted to go to that house because they knew it would be an easy target because there was only one man there. So just overall disgusting. The four soldiers of the six-man unit responsible for the checkpoint, Barker, Cortez, Green, and Spielman, then left their post for Abir's home. Two men, Howard and another soldier, remained at the post. Howard had not been involved in the discussion to rape and murder the family. He heard the four men talking about it and saw them leave, but he thought that they were just joking and they were planning to beat up some Iraqi men to just blow off steam instead.
Okay, even that
is wrong.
Is wrong.
Yeah. The sixth soldier that was at the checkpoint had absolutely no knowledge of what was going on. On the day of the massacre, Abir's father, Qassam, was enjoying time with his family while his sons were at school. In broad daylight, the five soldiers walked to the house, not wearing their uniforms, but wearing army-issued long underwear to look like ninjas, and separated 14-year-old Abir and her family into two different rooms. Spielman was responsible for grabbing Abir's 6-year-old sister, who was outside the house with her father, and bringing her inside. Green then broke Abir's mother's arms, likely because of a struggle that resulted when she heard her daughter being raped in the other room, and murdered her parents and younger sister while the two other soldiers, Cortez and Barker, raped a beer. Barker wrote that Cortez pushed a beer to the floor, lifted her dress, and tore off her underwear while she struggled. According to Cortez, a beer kept squirming and trying to keep her legs closed and saying stuff in Arabic. As he and Barker took turns holding her down and raping her, Cortez testified that Abir heard gunshots in the other room, which her parents and little sister were being held in, causing her to scream and cry even more as she was violently being raped by the men. Green then emerged from the room saying, "I just killed them. All are dead." Green, who later said that the crime was awesome, then raped Abir and shot her in the head several times. After the massacre, Barker poured petrol on Abir and the soldiers set fire to the lower part of the girl's body, from her stomach down to her feet. Barker testified that the soldiers gave Spielman their bloodied clothes to burn and he threw the AK-47 used to murder the family into a canal. They then left to celebrate the crime with a meal of chicken wings.
Also, I didn't realize they killed a 6-year-old as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so her parents, her who was 14, and then a 6-year-old girl. It's really sad.
And they did this during the day because the two brothers were still at school.
Yeah, broad daylight they did this.
The audacity where these men can just walk around and act like they own a foreign country and in the middle of the day walk into someone's house and murder and rape.
Yeah, and then set fire to her body. Meanwhile, the fire from Abir's body eventually spread to the rest of the room, and the smoke alerted the neighbors, who were among the first to discover the scene. They ran to tell Abu Faris Janabi, Abir's uncle, that the farmhouse was on fire and that dead bodies could be seen inside the burning building. Janabi and his wife rushed to the farmhouse and doused some of the flames to get inside. Upon witnessing the scene inside, Janabi went to the checkpoint guarded by Iraqi army soldiers to report the crime. Abir's younger brothers, Ahmed and Mohammed, returned from school that afternoon to find smoke billowing from the windows. After going to their uncle's home, they returned to the house only to be traumatized, finding their father shot in the head, mother shot in the chest, 6-year-old sister Hadel shot in the face, and 14-year-old sister Abir's remains burning. So the Iraqi soldiers immediately went to examine the scene and thereafter went to an army checkpoint to report the incident. The checkpoint was different from the one being manned by the perpetrators, but after an hour, some soldiers from the checkpoint went to the farmhouse. These soldiers were accompanied by at least one of the perpetrators.
So he went back and was like, investigating the scene of the crime.
Yeah. Green and the other soldiers who participated in the incident lied to the Iraqi soldiers who arrived on the scene immediately after the incident, telling them that the massacre had been perpetrated by Sunni insurgents. These Iraq soldiers conveyed this information to Abir's uncle, who viewed the bodies. This lie prevented the event from getting recognized as a crime or widely reported amidst the widespread violence occurring in the occupation of Iraq. So, Sergeant Anthony Yerby learned of the massacre and told Private First Class Justin Watt that Green was a murderer. Watt conducted a personal inquiry about this alarming act by a fellow soldier and co-worker. He talked to other members of his platoon who revealed to him that the gang rape and murder had in fact occurred. Watt then reported what he believed to be true to another non-commissioned officer in his platoon, Sergeant John Diem. Watt trusted Diem. He told him that he knew of a terrible crime that had been committed and asked for his advice. And this is, like, actually, like, it makes me very angry. So he asked for advice knowing that if he had reported the crime, he would be considered a traitor to his unit and could possibly be killed by them.
What? So he thinks that his unit is going to murder him because he murdered someone else?
No. Watt is the one who... So he was told by Yerby that Green was a murderer. So Watt is trying to figure out how he's going to tell on these guys, because if he tells on them, then the rest of his platoon is going to think that he's a traitor and would kill him.
And turn on him and kill him too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, I misunderstood.
Diem told Watt to be cautious, but that he had a duty as an honorable soldier to report the crimes to the proper authorities. Unfortunately, they did not trust their chain of command to protect them if they reported a war crime. As a result, Watt asked to speak with a mental health counselor, thereby passing the chain of command to report the crimes. On June 22, 2006, the rape and murders came to light when Watt revealed them during a mental health counseling session and then to Army criminal investigators. So it's crazy that he, like, couldn't go to his boss and tell them, like, what had happened, and that he had to, like, go talk to a therapist about it because that was, like, the only way that he felt comfortable getting that information out to keep his identity secret. But before Watt had reported the crimes, Green had been honorably discharged from the Army on May 16th, 2006, before the crimes were recognized, with antisocial personality disorder. The FBI assumed jurisdiction for the crimes committed by Green under a Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act in the U.S. Department of Justice and charged him with the murders. So, Stephen Green was arrested in North Carolina while traveling home from Arlington, Virginia, where he attended a funeral of a soldier. On June 30th, 2006, the FBI arrested Green, who was held without bond and transferred to Louisville, Kentucky. On July 3rd, federal prosecutors formally charged him with raping and murdering a beer and with the murder of her parents and younger sister. On July 10th, the U.S. Army charged the four other active duty soldiers with the same crime, and the sixth soldier, Yerby, was charged for failing to report the attack but not having participated in the massacre, which I think is awful because he told, like, someone above him about the crime, and even that person was afraid to report it. So why is he now being...
So was that person also charged with not reporting a crime?
No.
They should be.
What?
Because technically they're the one that didn't report it because it was his job to report it because he was the superior and needs to go up the chain of command, doesn't it?
Okay, so Yerby was another soldier in the fleet with, like, Green, like, same level.
Yeah.
And then Watt was above him, and he was told by someone above him that he should report the crime, but to be cautious because he might be murdered by his other soldiers. So instead of reporting it to a boss because he didn't trust him, he reported it to a mental health official so that therapist could... So that guy... So Watt, the one who eventually told, was notified by Yerby, and Yerby only told him because he didn't know what to do because he was scared. So I don't know why... Like, I feel like it was wrong because, like... If he hadn't told anyone, then Watt wouldn't have been able to tell the therapist that it had happened.
Maybe there's something that we don't know.
Yeah. So he wasn't charged with the attack, but he was charged with failing to report it. But he kind of did in a way. So on November 15th, 2006, Specialist James Barker pled guilty to the rape and murder as a plea agreement requiring him to give evidence against the other soldiers to avoid the death penalty. He was sentenced to 90 years in prison and must serve 20 years before being considered for parole, following which he would then be dishonorably discharged. Which I think is weird because, like, I guess because these people were still in the military, I guess they go to, like, because it's military court, and then I guess they go to military jail, but they can't be dishonorably discharged until after they finish their sentencing.
Because they need to be in the military jail.
Yeah.
And they need to be in the military. Yeah. It's very weird.
I know, right? So he must serve 20 years before being considered for parole, following which he would be dishonorably discharged. Barker wept during the closing statements and accepted responsibility for the rape and murders, saying that the violence he had encountered in Iraq left him angry and mean towards Iraqis. He is currently being held in the United States Disciplinary Barracks at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. Which, you don't get to be mad and angry and mean towards people. No, that just reminded me something that I feel is important to share. But I was talking to my therapist, and we were talking about how, like, showing your emotions and all that kind of stuff is, like, healthy. And crying is a healthy thing that you do. And he was saying that the phrase, men don't cry, I didn't know where that originated. Do you know?
Does it originate from the military?
It originates from the war. And it was used as a safety measure because when you were fighting, if you were crying, you couldn't aim very well because you were shaking and because you couldn't see, because you had tears in your eyes. So at that point in time, it was a safety mechanism to protect yourself. But today, you don't need, none of us are fighting in the war, or not none of us, but it's not a regular occurrence for all, you know, 18-year-old mm-hmm. boys to get shipped off to the military. So there's no need to say that anymore because they're not actually going into a situation where they're being told that they shouldn't cry because in order to protect them.
So it didn't start off as a men don't cry because men aren't supposed to show their feelings. It started off men don't cry because if you cry, you're not going to be able to survive the war.
Yeah.
But then they probably, the men who fought in World War One or World War Two, raised their boys with that saying and kind of flipped it. And yeah.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Isn't that
crazy? I love learning about the origins of things. And then it was like completely different to what we know today.
Yeah. Right. I thought that, like, that was like a, like, mind blown, like, to find out that that's where that originated from.
Mm-hmm.
It is healthy to cry. It releases toxins and hormones in your brain that you need to get rid of. It is a good way to readjust your mental state. Crying is good. Anyways. Mm-hmm.
You always feel good after a good cry.
Yeah.
Maybe not right away, but like an hour later, you're like, oh, feel so lifted.
Yeah. On January 22nd, 2007, Megan got for her birthday Paul Cortez pleading guilty in a court martial to rape, conspiracy to rape, and 4 counts of murder as a part of a plea deal to avoid the death penalty, and he was sentenced to 100 years in prison followed by dishonorable discharge. He is currently being held in the state disciplinary barracks at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas as well.
Can I just say, I think that is a very good
birthday present.
Birthday gift.
Yeah.
Sending a guilty man to jail for a long time for terrorizing an entire family.
Yeah. And a community.
Yeah.
Okay, so then on August 3rd, 2007, Jesse V. Spielman, 23, was sentenced by a court-martial to 110 years in prison with the possibility of parole after 10 years followed by a dishonorable discharge. He was convicted of rape, conspiracy to commit rape, housebreaking with intent to rape, and 4 counts of felony murder. He had earlier pled guilty to lesser charges of conspiracy towards obstruction of justice, arson, wrongful touching of a corpse, and drinking. As of 2009, Spielman was being held in the United States Disciplinary Barracks at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Brian Howard was sentenced by a court-martial under a plea agreement for obstruction of justice and as an accessory after the fact. The court found that his involvement included hearing the others discuss the crime and lying to protect them, but not commission of the actual rape and murders. Howard was served to 27 months, after which he was dishonorably discharged. So Anthony W. Yerbe was initially charged with obstructing the investigation, specifically dereliction of duty and making a false statement. In exchange for his testimony against the other man, the government dropped the charges against him and accepted an administrative discharge characterized as other than honorable. So there's honorable discharge, other than honorable discharge, and dishonorable discharge.
You weren't honorable, but you weren't necessarily dishonorable, so you're just non-honorable.
What is it called?
You're mediocre.
No, there's heaven, purgatory.
You get a purgatory discharge. Yeah.
So Justin Watt, the whistleblower, received a medical discharge and is now running a computer business. He says that he received death threats after coming forward. However, stating in 2010, he was asked by the U.S. Army Center for the Army Profession and Ethic at West Point, New York, to be interviewed and speak before Army Profession audiences about his decision to report the crime in accordance with his moral obligation to uphold the Army ethic. Watt and Sergeant Diem have both done so, including venues at which hundreds of senior Army leaders were present, for which their acts were given standing ovations. So it's good that he is being treated so well for doing what he was supposed to do.
Doing the
bare minimum
thing and reporting a crime.
Yeah. Which I think is crazy that they're getting, like, it's a good thing that this is how, like, they're reciprocating his, because, like, that's how you teach people to, like, that's what they need to do, but it's sad that we have to teach people that that's what they need to do.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be, I mean, it's not necessarily the bare minimum because he knew his life was in danger.
Yeah.
Like, to come forward and be the whistleblower. But at the same time, it's horrible that the situation around him put his life in danger for being a decent human being and doing what we would consider the right thing to report a crime.
Yeah. His life shouldn't be in danger for something like that.
And I'm glad the military, like, is owning up to it and, like, working on how do we prevent this from ever happening again.
Yeah. No, it's very good of them. Okay, and finally, we're going to talk about Stephen Green, because he was kind of the one who started all of this. So Stephen Green, who was 19 when he committed the crime.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just awful. He was from Midland, Texas. He came from a broken and chaotic home. He was highly impulsive and did poorly in school. He got into the Army in 2005 on a so-called morals waiver, having had problems with alcohol and drug abuse. So he entered a plea of not guilty through his public defender on July 6th. On July 11th, his lawyers requested a gag order, because they thought that he wouldn't have access to a fair trial. But thankfully, on August 31st, the federal judge rejected the gag order and said that there is no reason to believe that Green's right to a fair trial would be in jeopardy. Furthermore, he added, it is beyond question that the charges against Mr. Green are serious ones and that some of the acts alleged in the complaint are considered unacceptable in our society. Also, I don't think I mentioned this, but because he was discharged before the crimes came to light, he's the only one who was not, he did not go to military court. He was actually went to, like, regular court, federal.
In, like, real prison.
Yeah. Okay, wrapping it up here. On May 7th, 2009, Green was found guilty by the federal court in Kentucky of rape and multiple counts of murder. While prosecutors sought the death penalty in the case, jurors failed to agree unanimously, and the death sentence could not be imposed. On September 4th, Green was formally sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole. Stephen Green's trial was the first capital punishment case tried under the 2000 law allowing federal crime courts to try crimes committed overseas by former members of the military, military dependents, contractors, and other civilians. Legal experts said Mr. Green left the army with a dishonorable discharge just weeks before his arrest. So at the time in Iraq, the Iraq insurgents was near its violent apex, and American forces were suffering heavy casualties. Private Green's unit, Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 502nd Infantry, 2nd Brigade Combat Team of the 101st Airborne Division. Like, why are their names
That's
so
a mouthful.
Hello, I am from Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 502nd Infantry, 2nd Brigade Combat Team of the 101st Airborne Division. That's a... You need to have good breath capacity to be able to say that all in one breath.
Sounds like Esteban Julio Ricardo Montoya.
Mom and Dad, that's from Suite Life on Deck. Wait, Suite Life of no, Zach, Suite Life and, of Zach Cody. And Cody. Oh my God, TM. They were sent to a particularly violent area that soldiers had called the Triangle of Death soon after arriving in Iraq of fall 2005. The battalion quickly suffered casualties, including a sergeant close to Private Green. In December, Private Green, along with other members of his platoon, told an army stress counselor that he wanted to take revenge on Iraqis, including civilians. The counselor labeled the unit as mission incapable because of poor morale, high combat stress, and anger over the deaths, and said it needed a stronger supervision and rest, which they did not receive. So Muhammad and Ahmed Qassam Hazam al-Jabini, the surviving brothers, now live with their uncle Qasim Hazam al-Jabani and are being raised by their uncle. And I will leave us off with the fact that Stephen, who was held in the U.S. penitentiary in Tucson, Arizona, died on February 15th, 2014, from complications following an attempted suicide by hanging. And that is the end of that. It's funny how he fought for not getting the death penalty, and then he committed suicide.
Yeah, I guess he wanted to die on his own terms.
Yeah.
That's a rough case, but it's a very important case to cover.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's important to talk about the fact that, you know, you need to be aware of everything, and, you know, there's lots of people who use their power for not good. As Spider-Man's uncle would say, with great power comes great responsibility. And clearly these men did not see the fact that they had responsibility to protect others instead of hurting them. I'm pretty sure that was Spider-Man's uncle who said that. Could be Batman's. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and they were, I don't know. Again, we were like 10 years old when this happened, so we don't really know everything that happened about, I don't know, what's it called, like Operation Desert Storm or the War on Terror or whatever, but it's kind of like the U.S. Army and the Canadian Army were there to quote-unquote protect people, like civilians from Taliban, Al-Qaeda, something. Again, I'm not
Sunni
very well
insurgents.
Because this happened when we were young children, but what I'm trying to say is they were there to protect and serve not just the USA, but civilians.
Yeah.
Where they were stationed.
I don't know much about the war either. All I know is that the US, a lot of people didn't want to go to war, and Bush said yes to the war, and then the Dixie Chicks wrote a song, or said that they were sad that the president was from where they were from, which is Texas, and then they got a whole bunch of hate. And the U.S. said that they were there to protect, but really it was about oil control. I could be wrong, but that's the information that I know.
No, sounds about right. It's very infuriating.
Yeah.
To say the least.
It makes me sad. You know, you hear more bad than you ever hear good, and you remember the bad more than you hear the good. And so I feel like we've kind of been bashing the army a little bit, or armies. But, you know, veterans are important and they protect us. And the ones who do good are amazing people. And we respect you. And thank you for putting your life on the line for mm-hmm. us to have rights. Okay, Megan, I'm done.
Okay, I'm going to jump in and get started with my case. And today I am taking you all to China. So my sources for this week are reddit.com, r/unsolvedmysteries thread by the user u.dq689, a supchina.com article by Robert Foyle Hunwick, and the YouTube channel Chao Kao Nocturne.
Yes, very different sources to mine.
Yes, so I'm guessing you can all assume and make the guess that this is an unsolved case this week, hence the Reddit thread. And I'm doing the murder of Zhao Aiqing. This happens in Nanjing, China, which is a city in western China, kind of like around Shanghai. Today, the city has over 8 million inhabitants, but in 1996, when our story begins, the city had around 5 million people.
Our birth year.
Yes, it actually happens in our birth month, too.
Whoa, this is like a birthday treat surprise extra bonus clip.
Yeah. Okay, so this crime happened like almost exactly like 25 years ago today. So on January 10th, 1996, a 20-year-old university student named Zhao Aiqing left her university dorm in Nanjing, China at about 8 p.m. She had not gone to her classes that day, but instead hung around the university dorms until the evening. Reportedly, she and her roommates had gotten into a bit of an argument or a tiff about roommate things that day, and Zhao Aiqing reportedly left somewhat angrily and said she was going to go for a walk.
What is with you and university roommates this week? Or the last couple weeks?
I know.
That's crazy.
I must be obsessed with higher education or something.
Possibly.
So Zhao Aiqing was new to the city, having only lived in Nanjing for about 3.5 months. She was shy and isolated herself and did not know many people around town. She was from a small village elsewhere in China and came from a poor to lower middle class family. Zhao Aiqing was last seen alive walking down Qingdao Road, not too far from the university campus. She was wearing a red coat, a style that was very popular in China at the time, and she never returned back to her dorm. Her roommates reported her missing, and they searched for her, but they could not find her. 9 days later, on January 19th, a street cleaner was cleaning the streets in the city center nearby the university. There had been a snow overnight and the streets were cold. While cleaning in an alleyway, the street cleaner found what she thought looked to be a bag of cooked meat inside a garbage can. She was excited as she thought it was pork, and she brought the meat home because it looked good still. Once home, she began to wash it. The meat was sliced into small pieces, so she washed each piece individually. However, after watching a bunch of pieces, she pulled a human finger out of the bag.
No, 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 no.
So, yes, just a warning, this is quite a horrific, graphic murder. So the woman immediately called the police. The police conducted a search of the nearby area and eventually uncovered more bags of body parts across the university campus and nearby areas, all cut into small pieces, except for half of a human head that was found in one of them. Each one was either wrapped in a blanket or carefully packed into plastic bags and placed in the garbage. The body was later identified to be that of Zhao Aiqing, the university student who had gone missing. Zhao Aiqing's body had been cut up into over 2,000 pieces and then boiled. Her family had to identify her from the scraps of clothing that remained in some of the bags and by a mole on her left cheek.
That's actually absurd. 2,000 pieces?
Yeah, it's really horrible.
Oh my god. Like, clearly that woman didn't know that she was touching a human because, like, those pieces must have been, like, that's so small. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm.
Thank God she didn't eat it because she thought it was pork.
Yeah, good thing the finger wasn't there.
Police set up a task force and conducted a thorough investigation into people who may have been in the area of Dao Aiching's disappearance. They searched university dorms and interviewed women students and held what was described as a symposium. So I guess like a meeting where they spoke about the crime and asked anyone if they could think of anything that might help or if they had seen anything. But looks like they only did that with women. Because of the extremity of the crime, the case blew up in Chinese media. An extra layer of mystique, I guess you could say, was the fact that the victim was last seen in a red coat. Red is a significant color in Chinese culture, as it is said to be the color of God and holds a lot of spiritual and ritual and religious importance. Because the victim was last seen in the red coat, this added an aura of supernatural to the murder in addition to it being so horrible.
Isn't red also like lucky?
I think so.
So that's kind of like opposite. I don't know what I was trying to get with that, but like that could also like mean something because like maybe like that's something that you feel like you're being protected while you're wearing that because it's luck and then it doesn't protect you.
Yeah, and people are freaking out because red is supposed to be lucky and this girl was not lucky. Police also searched the surrounding homes and university dorms near the campus. They figured the person who had murdered Dao Aiching would have to dismember her in their kitchen, and they searched nearly every kitchen they could in Nanjing, apparently. In addition, police determined that most of her remains had been cooked and boiled for multiple days. Some of her remains were missing. However, there were a lot of bones missing. Some people said there were no bones. Some people said there were bones, but only some in the bags. But her spleen was missing, her heart was missing, her intestines were missing, and her liver was missing as well.
Black market heart transplants?
Maybe.
I hope they weren't eaten. I feel like that's what you're going to get at, is that somebody ate her. Because they were boiled and parts of her were missing, but that's where I feel like it's kind of going. They decided that they actually didn't like how she tasted.
Ooh.
Sorry.
You whispered that into the mic so creepily.
Sorry.
So the only thing the police knew was that the person who dismembered Dao Aiching must have some sort of medical background and knowledge of anatomy. Maybe he was a doctor, or maybe even he was a butcher. Her remains were dismembered in an almost professional manner, so only someone who knew what they were doing could have done this. For this reason, police set their sights on a medical student at Nanjing University. There wasn't a lot of information about this student, no details, but they had this student as a key suspect for a couple of months, reportedly. But then after that, and not seeing any new evidence and nothing else coming up from any of the interviews with him or the investigation into him, they had to kind of stop looking into him as a suspect. The very odd thing is that many people think it would be extremely hard for someone to kidnap, murder, and dismember someone in that area of Nanking or Nanjing, as it is very populated, and someone must have seen something. Everyone was so shocked that no one had seen anyone because it's a very dense city. The university has a lot of people coming and going because it's a big campus. So people were really shocked that the police couldn't find anything. But nothing else came up. Police found no clues, no more evidence other than Dao Aiching's body. The investigation fizzled out with no leads. Even so, the notes they took on the case were astounding. They filled notebooks upon notebooks, which could be apparently stacked in piles the height of a person. So they had a lot of notes on the case, but just nothing could be found out.
That's so sad that, like, it must have really concerned everyone who lived in that region because, like, you kind of feel like you've got a sense of safety because there's so many people around to, like, nothing can happen to you. And then, again, something bad happens when you feel protected.
Yeah, I definitely feel safer when there's a lot of people around in, like, a busy area of a city.
Yeah, it's not as scary walking down streets alone.
Yeah. Sadly, Dao Aitung's family, who had come into the city once they found out their daughter was missing, they had to return home to their village with no news. No new information, not even any clues had come up about what had happened to their daughter and their sister. After 3 months with no news, the police task force was disbanded and the newspapers no longer reported on it. 8 years later, with the development of new DNA technologies, police reinvestigated the evidence in Dao Aiching's case to see if there were any DNA on her remains, because at that time, 1996 in China, they did not have like DNA investigations, evidence, like they didn't seem to collect DNA. Some of the articles I read said that technology was a little, like investigative technology was just a little bit behind in China at that point. So when they finally got good DNA testing, probably earlier than 8 years later, but they reinvestigated the evidence in Dao Aiching's case. But unfortunately, there was no DNA that they could find on her remains, and this too caused them to hit a dead end. So unfortunately, that is where the case stands today. So let's get into a couple theories. This case is super, super popular on Chinese social media and for like true crime addicts in China. And there's a bunch of theories, but unfortunately, it's only popular on Chinese social media. So I really had to dig deep to find any information. I tried to translate a couple articles, but the translate, like Google Translate between Mandarin and English was so horrible that I could not get anything from that. So I would assume it's because it's all in Mandarin and it's also behind the like Chinese internet firewall. So there might be a lot of good information out there, but it's only on Chinese websites and Chinese social media, which I do not have access to. Okay, so one theory is that the police already knew who did it, but were not able to investigate the person for some reason, maybe because they were wealthy or they were powerful or both. This would kind of make sense as a theory because they had so many notes of the investigation that people are like, well, you have all this evidence, like, why haven't you caught the person yet? What's the reason? Another theory is that one of the roommates did it. I think that was the police's initial theory, but there's really nothing to support this other than the fact that the roommates had a little argument about something, but nothing, like, there's nothing to support this at all.
Yeah, and roommate tiffs are normal.
Yeah, unless you're the person from last week. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I wouldn't say every time someone has a fight when they're roommates, it leads to murder, so.
Mm-hmm. You want to spill the tea on your roommates?
I haven't murdered either of them yet, so I think we're all good. They haven't killed me, and I'm probably the more annoying one out of the three of us. My OCD is like, no, you have to put that back.
You're constantly like, you guys, I can hear you talking in the hallway. I'm trying to record my podcast. Yeah.
No talking, keeping the space ridiculously clean. It's, yeah, I'm sorry.
So I think we've all just discovered that Tegan is the bad roommate.
Yeah.
Oh, no. So in June 2008, a blogger called Black Mass on the Chinese website BBS posted and said he had solved the case. So this kind of blew up in China, reportedly, and so let's get into this theory. Black Mass said that he looked into Dao Aiching's habit of taking walks. He said that she had a usual walking route which went off the university campus and along a road that had a lot of like unlicensed market stalls with people selling goods along it. Black Mass argues that Dao Aiching was probably a really lonely person, because she was shy and isolated, and that she likely walked down this road to stop and chat with the people selling their things. Black Mass presents the theory that Dao Aiching was really into metal music, and one of these vendors sold bootleg foreign music albums, and that Dao Aiching befriended him over time. Black Mass thinks that these two struck up a romance, which turned deadly. The blogger Black Mass thinks that this person cut up her body as a type of ritual to atone for his sins and to claim her soul or something, because he was, you know, so into death metal music.
That is so crazy. I think all the like murders around death metal music are absolutely insane. Like, I don't think that there's like really any other type of music where people get like so ritualistic about things. I mean, there is the Frank Sinatra song that people in the Philippines will kill other people over if they sing it poorly.
Yeah, the karaoke murders, My Way.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
But like, other than that, like, there's really, I feel like it's not like people hear like pop music and they're like, I must ritualize someone over it. I have a sidetrack story to tell.
Okay.
Regarding Norwegian metal music, I believe. So, in the house that I grew up in, we had this pretty, like, a decently high fence. Like, our backyard was pretty private until the people behind us decided to build up their backyard so that, like, their backyard, the ground was equivalent in height to the top of our fence. So we could basically see their entire backyard, and they could look down into our backyard. So, like, absolutely no privacy anymore. And
that's kind of weird.
Yeah, it's to us. Pretty rude.
To Mike in the Netherlands, he'd be like, oh, yeah, that's normal. If I can't look into my neighbor's house and see what they're doing, that's weird. Yeah.
Well, we had privacy. And the first day that they moved in, my sister and I, we had gotten gifted this like face paint set, and it was like big, like long, like it was kind of like in plastic tubes, so like you could actually use it pretty well. And so I put all of this white face paint on my sister's face, and then like with purple, like I drew all over her face and like just did like crazy face makeup to her. Like, we were like, I think 9 and 12 at this point, maybe a little bit older. But then my dad got our jukebox or boombox or whatever it's called, and he put on this like Norwegian death metal music and just blasted it, and my sister and I were doing like this interpretive dance covered in face paint in the backyard. We're like, this will show them. We're just like,
and your neighbors moved out the next week because they were so horrified that you might murder them.
I did not ever see them in their backyard ever again.
So of course this post about this blogger Black Mass's theory went absolutely viral on Chinese social media. Police even saw it and thought it could be a confession, and some saw it and were completely sold with the idea. I guess the myth that heavy metal music leads to sadistic murder exists in China, too. So, it's kind of funny. Police tracked down Black Mass and deleted his post and his account, but only after confirming his identity. He was a 26-year-old student who was way too young to be a suspect, and I guess he just had a wild imagination. And finally, the most compelling theory to me, because I always like a bit of conspiracy. I am an Aquarius. I love to conspire about conspiracy theories. A large theory on Chinese blogs and social media is that Dao Aiqing was kidnapped and harvested for her organs.
Which was right.
Your theory.
Oh, I love it.
There was a historic intestine transplant at the university right in between the date that she went missing and the date that she was found. People believe that her organs were boiled because this would get rid of any trace of anesthesia used in her remains. Her remains were also, as I said, expertly dismembered, and this would fit the theory of her being dismembered by a medical professional. The surgeons that performed this historic transplant never cited their source of the intestine they used for the transplant, and the surgery brought like international attention to the Chinese medical sphere and thrust the two doctors to like the peak of their careers. So Dao Aiqing's remains were also found scattered around or just off the campus grounds of the university where the surgery took place. And finally, either one of the doctors or the brother of one of the doctors committed suicide 15 years after the surgery. People believe that he could not live any longer with the fact that he had kidnapped and murdered a girl for her intestine for the surgery.
That's actually wild. I was like, I don't think Megan's gonna have a better theory than, like, the black mass one, but, like, now I'm just like, that makes sense. That's that. I didn't even think about boiling would get rid of the anesthesia.
Yeah. So I think it's either that or someone had plans to cannibalize her. But it's just so sad and probably really terrifying that we have no idea what actually happened to Dao Aiching.
That also reminds me, I don't know if you've been in town while this happens because Megan likes to travel to other regions and leave me alone to be without my best friend. But anyways, in front of our art gallery in Vancouver, it's pretty known, like, that's the spot where, like, you hold your protests and stuff. And when I used to work downtown, there was always this group. And I can't remember the name of them, but they were always protesting something in China where, like, the Chinese government, like, imprisons people and then because of their certain religion and then uses them as organ, like, to harvest organs from them. So I wonder if that had anything to do with it.
Oh, my God. Is that proven or is that conspiracy?
No, I think it's proven because there's a protest group that, like, is constantly, like, downtown, like, talking about how, like, this like, certain religious group is being imprisoned by Chinese authorities, and then...
Is it Uyghur Muslims? Because they have concentration camps in China for Uyghur Muslims, which is horrifying.
Let me look it up while you continue your story. I don't think so. I think it's a certain Chinese religion. But yeah, continue on and I will figure out what it's called.
Are they doing like Tai Chi or yoga or something?
No, it's so absurd. The first time that I saw it, I was so confused because they had like this like little like presentation where they had like five or six people like pretending to be doctors and then someone laying on like a hospital like surgery table and then other people like chained up like to like bars and they like pretend to be cutting into this person and like taking their organs out. Like it was like a whole show that they did and they were down there for days and like they would try and like get you to like fill in like things to like write into the Canadian government asking for support to like help these people out in China.
I have never heard of that. I know right now in China, in the eastern part of China, there is an ethnic group and religious group called Uyghur and Uyghur Muslims, and the Chinese government is actively placing them in work camps and essentially concentration camps, and they are removing the children from the parents, and they're forcing Uyghur women, they're taking the men out of the homes and making like a Chinese man live in the home with a Uyghur woman. It's like horrible because it's not their husband. And they like force them, like they can't wear hijab and they're being forced into work camps and prisons for practicing the religion. Like even if someone says, oh, I think I saw that person praying, like straight to one of these work camps, straight to jail. And they've removed the children and are putting them into schools like kindergartens and are like teaching them propaganda and brainwashing them. And it's literally is genocide. But there is a fantastic Vice documentary. I know not all of Vice documentaries are good, but these two women go undercover and they travel to the eastern province of China and kind of poke around for any information. And I can link it in our show notes because it's really surreal.
That reminds me of another group in China called the Mosu people, and they are a small ethnic group living in the Lugu Lake province, and they are a matriarchal society. So there's a lot of people have issues with how they view sexuality and how the women in the community are the ones in power. But I just looked it up. It's the Falun Gong harvesting. Falun Gong practitioners who were imprisoned in Chinese detention centers and labor camps report going unexplained medical examinations and blood tests as precursors to live organ harvesting, while doctors who were involved in the practice report basements filled with live prisoners whose organs were being used.
What?
Yeah, so we can attach that in our show notes as well.
Okay, yeah. So let's link both of those in our show notes, because I think those are both really serious issues.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, so that is the murder of Dao Aiting in China. And sadly, it's not, like, there's no information on it.
It goes all the way to the top.
What actually happened.
It goes all the way to the top! This episode, I feel like, has been good. Very sidetracked, though.
Yeah, apologies if you're just here for the story and that's it. Yeah. But
we have lots of other good information to share.
Yeah, we had some stuff to get off our chests and rant about.
I just wanted your post, or what am I saying? You talking about how, like, things, like, don't translate properly.
Yeah.
I'm going to give another shout out to, I think, both Megan and my favorite podcast called My Favorite Murder. If you're looking for a good murder podcast other than this one, we're not saying convert to them, but if you want to include more in your podcast listening, definitely give them a listen. They're so hilarious. But they have a book that came out called Stay Sexy, Don't Get Murdered, and they just got it published in Korea. And it translates...
Oh, I saw that!
Yeah. So, Stay Sexy and Don't Get Murdered translate to... Mom and Dad, I'm sorry for my swearing, but it translates to Be a Selfish Bitch, Realistic Fucking Advice from Cool Sisters. And then, there's a little band around the book that says, Dear All Women, I Love, Be a Fucking Selfish Bitch.
I love that.
Which I think
That's
is
so funny.
So hilarious. How Stay Sexy, Don't Get Murdered translates
to that.
To that.
That's funny. I love, like, interesting translations. But also, speaking of conspiracies, like, we spoke about a couple conspiracies, and since it's Aquarius season, I'm just gonna jump into, I'm very upset that this week someone presented proof to me that the moon landing was not faked.
Okay, see, I don't like that because I've kind of just bandwagoned onto that conspiracy theory that it is fake because that doesn't make sense.
It makes sense as to why the U.S. government would want to fake the moon landing.
Yeah.
Because they were in a space race with the USSR. They were in the whole Cold War. It makes complete sense as to why they would want to fake the moon landing. But... here's why it was actually... Also, we haven't been to the moon since,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure.
That's what I'm saying. Computers were the size of rooms at that point. How the hell did we get someone on the moon and get them to come back? And now phones are better computers than the size of my hand. And why haven't we been back?
Yeah. I mean, just to clear it up, I don't believe it was fake. I don't believe it was real. I'm just kind of like...
You're playing
whatever
devil's
about
advocate
it.
Right now.
Yeah, we're playing devil's advocate right now. But the reason, like the proof that I was presented this week, which in my head makes complete sense and I will believe the proof, there was a video where this guy was showing how a studio light works versus the sun. A studio light, so for example, if it was faked in studio with like that Armstrong guy walking in a spacesuit on the quote-unquote moon in a studio, their shadows would have been angled because the studio light comes from one. We can post this on our Instagram so you can actually watch what I'm looking at instead of listening to me explain it. But the studio light goes at an angle from the studio light, which means that their shadows are not parallel. But in all of the photos of the moon landing, their shadows are parallel, and the only way that can happen is if it's a shadow by the sun. So there is your definitive proof to all my other Aquarians out there who just loved the conspiracy of it, thinking the moon landing was fake. There's your proof. It was real.
Unless they filmed it outside.
Unless they filmed it outside. Tegan.
At Area 51, which is a top secret area that nobody's allowed into, so there probably wouldn't be anyone over the area with cameras to be able to see it.
And it's isn't that in Nevada or Utah? It looks like the moon.
Yeah. I just busted.
Oh no. I've been presented with new information and I'm back to thinking it was a conspiracy.
But that does make a lot of sense because they probably would have filmed it in a studio to keep it very private. And I'm sure that they wouldn't have thought about the fact that studio lighting is at a different angle than the lighting that the sun provides. I mean, it makes sense.
But it does still stand. There is a reason why the U.S. would have wanted to fake it. Mm-hmm. So politically, it did make sense as a possibility, but it wasn't fake.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite conspiracy theory at all? Or you can change the subject, I don't.
I would say that I don't like thinking about conspiracy theories because I have existential crises a lot. It makes me very uncomfortable. I don't like thinking about it because my brain works very hard to mm-hmm. make me feel like this world is not real. The one that I've really been with is the moon recently. Pizzagate and all that kind of stuff.
What is Pizzagate?
Like the whole Wayfair.
I don't know what that is.
The Wayfair thing that was happening a little while ago, where the names of furniture that was being sold on Wayfair was the same name as people who had gone missing, and they were charging crazy amount of money for a chest of drawers, like just a regular set of wooden drawers, and it would be $30,000. And it was all matching up with a missing children.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was pretty intense, but yeah.
I remember one of the children who was missing came forward and she's like, guys, I literally that poster is 10 years old. I was found.
Yeah.
I'm not missing. This is literally just a conspiracy theory. It's not real.
That just reminded me of a TikTok I watched this morning where the psychic was being interviewed and the interviewer held up this picture of this little girl and she was like, do you know who this is? And she's like, yeah, it was a case that I worked on. That little girl went missing and she was murdered. And the reporter was like, that's interesting because that little girl is actually me. I'm not dead. And she's like, well, that's interesting.
Do you have a twin? Oh, you must have eaten your twin in the womb. And that's who I was speaking to.
Yeah, clearly. No, it's pretty funny. What other things have happened this week? I've not given away any of my organs. I have not given away any more bodily fluid. I finished my book, Normal People. It was really good. I would highly recommend that book to read if you like books. It was a very different way to read because I find that most books, when people are talking, it's in air quotes, but this was written in a style of second person narration, because there's first person, second person, and third person. I think it's second person narration. So it's like you're there, but like you're not actually there. Like you're just seeing it all happen. So there was like no like actual dialogue. I don't know how to explain it, but it was really good. And I'm really upset because there's not a second book. Yeah.
I think there's a show, though.
Yeah, there is a show.
Yeah. It was, like, blowing up earlier this year.
Last year.
I think it's on the BBC, or it's, like, an English
show. Yeah, it is. I would like to watch it, because I don't know how it's going to end. But, yeah, it's really good. I also want to suggest one more book, because someone sent it to me, and I think that it is the best thing I've ever seen. It's called Murder with Macaroni and Cheese. So it's a, it's a pasta cookbook that talks about murder.
Oh, that's so funny.
Murder's on the Menu, a soul food mystery. Mahalia Watkins soul food mystery. Yeah. Hmm. So that's kind of fun. Okay, well.
Should we pull our countries?
Yeah. Oh, we should talk about the birthday special first.
Right. Yes. So this episode comes out on January 20th. The following week, January 27th, we will be doing a special birthday episode. And like I mentioned at the top of the show, Tegan and I will get to choose whatever thing we want.
Yeah.
So the countries that we will be about to pull, we are pulling them for our February 3rd, episode 16.
Yeah.
Okay, Tegan, are you ready to find out where you're going, not next week, but the week after?
I am. Where are we going?
You are going to Turkey.
Ooh. My mom is going to love that.
Yeah, I was like, your mom's going to be happy about that.
Her favorite place in the world is Turkey, I think. She loves Turkey. They went there a couple years ago. And they didn't bring me. I would like to go to Turkey. Yeah, it looks really cool. Where's Megan going?
I'm going to Hong Kong.
Ooh.
So I just did China, and now I'm going to Hong Kong.
That's crazy.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah, you're keeping it in the Asian territory.
Keeping it in Asia.
And I'm keeping it in the Middle East because I just went to Iraq.
Yeah.
Wow.
Look at that. Look at that.
We're planning so much better with our flight airfares, you know, keeping it local before traveling. You know, it's just a lot cheaper that way.
Yeah, it's way cheaper. We're kind of running low on our podcast budget.
Yeah.
So.
keep rate, reviewing, and subscribing, because that keeps our podcast budget afloat. Just kidding. We don't have a budget.
Alrighty, well, don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, like Tegan said, so we can keep this podcast budget up to par, so we can keep traveling.
Ciao. Anyways.
What did we decide last time, Tegan? We decided that we're going to say goodbye in the language from our country. So mainland China mainly speaks Mandarin, so I've forgotten how to say this already.
Zaijian. Zaijian. I know how to say that. Is like really one of the only things I need to know how to say in Chinese. Zaijian. Wadan. That's how the person on Google says it. Wadan. Wadan.
Zaijie. Wadan.
Goodbye.
Be in your ear holes next week. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Wadan. Zaijian.
Zaijie.
Peace out.
Well done. Bye.
Bye.